Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Maurice Ruett. Maurice, how are you doing?
Good afternoon, Nick.
I'm pretty good. We're also joined today by Makone Maja. Makone, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Very good to have you guys with us. For those of you watching live, apologies for starting a bit late. We had to get some things in order, but those things are now in order. So let's start off with the first thing, which is a little bit of interesting discussion on the nation's opinion pages. I don't know what his position is anymore, current editor, former editor. Anyway, Peter Bruce, who has often made quite a lot of waves with his columns, wrote this piece, which was quite frustrating, but sort of generally in some ways in the right direction. But let me explain. So the piece is titled Waiting in Vain for BEE Boffins to Make the Investment Case. He said, no one has described how the law requiring investors to share 30% of an SA venture would make them invest. So I'm going to quote a bit from the piece here. Peter Bruce says, I don't know about you, but I'm still waiting for just one of the many articles or speeches being made in defense of BEE to make the economic investment case for it. I've read and listened to everything I can find in the past few months as BEE issue has become more prominent and more emotional, and no one has even bothered to try and describe how the law requiring investors to share 30% of their ventures in SA with black shareholders would make them more rather than less likely to invest. It is the only question worth asking. Instead, on both sides of the debate, increasingly angry contributors are drifting off the point. Why suddenly have we surveys showing the most black South Africans wanted scrapped? Seriously? How many people did they ask? Turns out, not many. Then someone calculates that BEE has cost the country 2 to 4% of its GDP. Really, it's a guess at best. The side in favor of BEE is equally flighty. The attack on BEE is an attempt by whites to somehow, quote, keep control of the economy or to bring back apartheid, and it is frequently and mischievously painted as an attack on affirmative action generally, which it surely is not. He finishes this off by saying, I can't prove that BEE and the 30% requirement are a barrier, but can anyone explain the attractions there might be of surrendering 30% of your investment in SA before you even start doing business here? What's the investment case for that requirement? Maurice, let me start with you. This is really frustrating because he's completely correct when he says that there is no real business investment argument for BEE. As we've said many times before and explained and shown in many different papers and bits of research that have been done, this is obviously a disincentive, particularly to foreign investors, but also to local South African investors to invest in businesses if you have to start off by giving away 30% of your company, almost always to someone who is a politically connected entrepreneur. And he's correct in highlighting this doesn't, you know, that BEE hasn't been really doing much to help ordinary South Africans. But then he kind of is trying to look like some sort of impartial both sides are kind of guy on this issue. And he says, well, the people attacking BEE are coming up with these nonsense surveys that most black South Africans wanted scrapped. Okay. This is an endless point of frustration. Surveys don't have to ask the whole population or even tens of thousands of people to get an accurate result. This is a thing we've been over many times in polling. You only need a representative sample of a sufficient size. That sufficient size can be somewhere around 1,000 people. But as long as it is accurate to what the population looks like, you will get a realistic answer. This is best practice in polling all over the world. It is done by businesses in advertising. It is done by political parties and commentators when they're trying to find out our polling has done this. Ipsos does this. Name a polling company, they do this, right? The only exceptions are the really big polling initiatives like the Quarterly Labor Force Survey where they need an extremely high degree of accuracy. But here he kind of has this sort of, I don't know what to call it, a drive-by attack on the survey showing that affirmative action is not very popular, by saying, oh, they didn't ask enough people. Well, no, those surveys do. And what they show is that black South Africans are really not nearly as keen on BEE as the common narrative would have it. Maurice, what do you make of all this?
Well, I just want to say, like, normally I quite like Peter Bruce's writing. And even this column, like, I quite enjoy it. He's got a very folksy way of writing and so on. But I'd say it's that is incredibly bad faith. Like, I really lose a lot of respect for anybody who claims to, understand the world. If they say, "Oh, well, they asked too few people, or they didn't ask me, I can, that they didn't ask me what my opinion is, the survey doesn't count," and it's just incredibly bad faith because, as you say, as long as there is a representative sample, if you're going to have a go at a survey, you need to look at its methodology. Any survey for a country the size of South Africa, if it's got even 600 people, then your margin of error starts getting a bit big. But even 600 people is actually not a bad number to poll a country as big as South Africa. If you're polling more than 1,000 people, that's actually fine. Even in America, a lot of the presidential polls that are pretty accurate, they only poll around about 1,000 people, and that's for a country of 350 million people. So I just found this an incredibly bad faith attack on, have a go at the methodology. That's what you should have a go at. But it's quite an economist's piece because, he's like got a very bovine way because he's saying on the other hand, on one hand and then on the other hand. How Nas Boerter used to say when he did the rugby commentary back in the day. But yeah, he says, we know B doesn't work, but also maybe it does work. And, and I have to say there's also, I found this one bit here quite infantilizing where he says, "As an editor of this newspaper 14 years, my black colleague, senior and less so, was central to practically every new insight into our society. I would not have survived without them. And anyone trying to keep black people out of their business in South Africa today is just a fool." Who? I mean, firstly, it's this kind of the magical Negro trope that like black people have this, insight into the world that white people don't have. It's actually quite infantilizing. And unless you are a massive white supremacist, which, I think, even if you do believe that no person can survive in South Africa if they are actual white supremacists, I don't think you just wouldn't be able to just live with white people and never interact with black people. No person in South Africa wants to keep black people out of their business. Most business owners, I'm sure the vast majority, want to get their business to grow, and they're going to hire the best person. Whether that person is white or black or Martian, they don't care. They want to hire the best person for the job. And he also buys in this thing that there's this kind of very reluctant class of business people in South Africa, of white business people who have an interest in keeping black people out of the economy or whatever the case is. It's complete nonsense. And I have to say, I mean, as I say, I like Peter Bruce's writing normally, but I thought this was quite a weak column, and I lost quite a lot of respect for him with his what's that comment about there being too few people polled.
What do you make of this? It's been kind of interesting that I think the DA in particular seems quite concerned with what Peter Bruce thinks. In that, I think it's because he's sort of, ideologically sympathetic to them, but never quite seems to give them the support that they have always wanted from him. And you can see this in a variety of things. I think the DA head of policy, Matt Cuthbert, recently had a go at him in a piece titled "The DA Learns Its Lessons from the Past," I think was the name. DA learns his lessons from history, sorry. And John Steenhuisen yesterday had a very brutal attack on him, where, oh, let me just read a bit of the Steenhuisen piece. "Peter Bruce, the more things change, the more they stay the same. If we went back in time for just a few months, it would have been difficult to imagine a more profound shift in SA politics than the one we are now living through. Even though many may now claim otherwise, 36, 24, even 12 months ago, very few pundits, including Bruce, believed support for the ANC was on the verge of collapsing from 57% to 40%. Few believed the DA was back on a growth trajectory after the party polled at just 16% following the debacle of the 2019 election." He goes on to say that Peter Bruce has basically been wrong and wrong again in various types of political prognosticating. Steenhuisen said, "The reality is that Bruce was wrong that the, quote, blessed moment of Cyril Ramaphosa's election as the ANC leader in 2017 would magically cure SA's ills. He was wrong the DA would not recover after Musima Mane walked off the job. He was wrong about the breakthrough prospects of his former close colleague, Songezo Zibi. And he was wrong that ANC support crashing in 2024 wouldn't happen." So this is kind of the background, I think, to Peter Bruce sort of doing his on the other end kind of thing here. What do you make of this? I think Marius said in an internal discussion, he just never quite seems to really want to have a full go at the sort of ANC edifice, even though he clearly sort of almost wants to. I don't know. What's your take on all this?
There's a great deal of insinuation in both pieces. from Mr. Bruce and Mr. Steenhuisen. But let's start with Mr. Bruce and the premise in this article, which is this idea that, you know, no one's ever really made the business case for or against the 30% ownership requirement of BEE. That's just false on its face, right? There's an EU report that was published, I think, in 2020, where it's actually titled EU Investors' Response to Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment, a Skills Enhancement Model. And they outline the EU's commitment to developing South Africa. But one of the first things they propose in terms of making South Africa more investable is, one, the conditional relaxing of Black equity ownership. And I'm reading directly from this report. Reducing the weighting of Black equity ownership and shifting the triple BEE points to favor job creation initiatives. And then the simplification of the EEIP, the Equity Equivalent Investment Program. So the idea that no one's ever tried to unpack whether, you know, 30% ownership hurts or helps investment is simply not true. A simple Google search would have helped Mr. Bruce get this source it from the investor's mouth, right? The EU as represented in South Africa. But also the insinuation is so frustrating, like you're saying, you know, it's like he wants to critique BEE, but he's very hesitant to. And so he has to introduce this question about investment and the attraction of investment that is South Africa when it's already been addressed. So it is really quite frustrating. And then Mr. Steenhuisen, I'm also not sympathetic to his article at all. I find that he carves out these niches in his article, you know, that are also very hard to find someone who's made the statements that he said nobody's made. You know, he says nobody predicted that the ANC would have fallen specifically from 57% to 40%. And that shows what a scam analysis and election predictions are. But also that no one could have predicted that the DA would have joined the GNU and helped, you know, stop or would go at all costs to stop the dark triad coalition of the MK, the EFF, and the ANC. Well, Mr. Steenhuisen, because you told us that the DA wouldn't ever join hands with the ANC to go into this coalition. But I do appreciate that he addresses Peter Bruce directly, because both of them use this idea of DA leadership. You know, it seems Mr. Steenhuisen's mostly referring to himself when he says DA leadership achieved all these things in the last 5 years, because Mr. Bruce singles out Helen Zille, you know, as a strong leader, as somebody who could change the fate of Johannesburg. But yeah, there's a lot of you know, innuendo on both sides that's equally frustrating.
I think, Maurice, what we're seeing here is sort of the fact that, you know, BEE has all these kind of sort of social taboos on the debate. You have to always sort of say, to be sure, you know, we need transformation, whatever, as a kind of thing. And you get these sort of muddled arguments coming out of people where, even when, you know, people are very correct about in this case, the investment harm that's done by BEE, as Bruce is. You sort of have these weird kind of asides of saying, no, but you see, I'm not a racist because I learned so many things from my Black colleagues. And you just, it just makes the whole debate stupid. because the reality is, if we want a country where most South Africans are not poor and have opportunities to live their lives, then that is what we need to consider the impact of BEE on. And Bruce is correct when he says that the defenders of BEE have made no real defense of that part of BEE. The defense, when it is given, is usually a very sort of vague racial thing of saying, well, you see, if there are rich Black people, they will give money and jobs to poor Black people because of racial solidarity or something like that, which is such a weak, tepid answer. It's kind of difficult to conceive of a sillier one. But anyway, final thoughts on this one.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It's just there's nobody is actually trying to defend it in real terms and say, this is actually what it's done. This is how it's grown the economy. And yeah, maybe there's an argument to say, there's no, like, it's hard to say that BEE's restricted the economy. But I mean, anybody would think, why would you come and invest in South Africa if you have to give up 30% of your business or whatever the case is? And, you know, even if you sell it, sell a bit of your business to, what do you call it, you know, a black businessman who's built his own business, you're now empowered because X amount of your business belongs to a black person. That guy goes and sells, and you sell to an overseas company or a white person. Now you're not empowered anymore. It's such a restriction on your business. And also just we have to, like, just talking about transformation. What does transformation mean? In any sense, South Africa's transformed. You can't say this country's the same as it was at the end of apartheid. I know some people disagree with me, but I think it's improved for the better. When is a country transformed? Does, as I've said before, is it when there's no more white people in public life, or white people only reflect their percentage in the population or whatever? And I've said it before, talking about the Springboks, and I'll also talk now about the Proteas, who won over the weekend, first ever world champion, or World Cup. I'm getting so excited. First, the ICC trophy for the Proteas. Lots of talk about how the Proteas is such a transformed team and all this stuff, because they got a black captain, you know, just like Siya Kolisi did for the Springboks, what Themba Bavuma did. 7 of the 11 were still white guys. There were 3 black guys and 1 Indian guy and 7 white guys. But now suddenly it's a magically transformed team. Is that team transformed? It's still majority white, but because they're winning and because they led by quite a guy with some gravitas and a bit of dignity, a guy like Themba Bavuma, people are like, oh no, it's a team's transformed. But so what does transformation mean? Is it just an organization where black and white people are working together on equal footing, like the Proteas and Springboks? Or does it mean that black people have to reflect their proportion in the population? It's all just, it's all just a sophistry, and it's all, it's just a load of rubbish at the end of the day. And also, as you say, we do need transformation, but transformation is where there's no more poverty in South Africa, or where, you know, only 5% of South Africans live in extreme poverty, not what we have today.
Okay, let's move on to our next story. This is perhaps of less grand importance to the fortunes of millions of people, but still interesting to talk about. And that is that Julius Malema has had his visa application to the UK denied. Now, this may sound a bit familiar, but when the story came up previously, the dispute was that Malema said he was being denied a visa, but the UK said, no, we're not denying your visa, we just weren't able to process it in time because of a bunch of public holidays. Well, they have processed the visa now, and they've denied it. And I think I did say something to this effect that at the time, I can't remember exactly what I said, but I think I said something along these lines, that if the UK government was going to deny Malema for a visa for his views, they would be pretty clear about it. Well, it turns out they were pretty clear about it when they did do that. The Home Secretary in the UK has said that they are not going to be granting a visa to Julius Malema to visit the country due to his extremism. And in particular, they cite two particular instances. They say his support for Hamas, which in the United Kingdom is regarded as a terrorist organization, as well as his comments about slitting the throat of whiteness that he made, I think, with reference to removing Mayor Athol Trollope from Nelson Mandela Bay a couple of years ago. The UK's Home Office said any future UK visa applications you make will be considered on their individual merits. However, you are likely to be refused unless the circumstances of your application change. In relation to this decision, there is no right of appeal or right of administrative review. McCorne, I think, you know, sort of what this is that Malema, let me first say this. It's not actually particularly unusual for the UK to deny various fairly famous people visas. Mandla Mandela, Nelson Mandela's grandson, was denied a UK visa also for his support of Hamas last year in October, I think it was. You've had people like the leader of the largest party in the Netherlands 16 years ago, Geert Wilders, was denied a visa for because he wanted to show a very controversial documentary about Islam in the UK. He was denied a visa. The American sort of alt-right media personality Laura Southern She was denied entry to the UK because of her criticism of Islam. So this is not particularly unusual for the UK's government. But I do think that, you know, with Malema kind of basically being brought up in the White House and having this more global attention shown to South Africa, that, you know, the chickens in a way are coming home to roost, that all these years of this kind of really overheated revolutionary racial rhetoric is sort of now being rejected by the countries that were being attacked. I mean, why would the UK let you in if the purpose of your visit is to go up, go to the UK, give some speech, which will no doubt have race baiting and stir up some racial hatred in it, and then also, you know, just spend the whole time attacking the UK as some evil colonial construct? What's your take on the story, McCormick?
So you've made my case for me, actually. I was going to say that the UK has denied visas for far less, and they've taken serious actions against, even this isn't visa related, but the former owner of Chelsea had to, you know, sell his stake in the club because of proximity to Vladimir Putin, which he's denied. So, you know, they've taken serious actions against people for far, I would say, far less things. South Africa's graylisted country, and one of those reasons is terrorist financing. And you hear Maluma say, you know, if the EFF were to ever be president of South Africa, they'd help arm terrorist groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. So I'm not really convinced that the Trump thing put him on the radar, in the UK radar, because I would have wanted to see more statements related to the Kill the Boer song being made. And this report doesn't really hinge on that. It almost, most of it, it seems to me, is about the support for these two terrorist groups. And then there's that comment about, you know, slitting whiteness or slaughtering white people. And he has said, you know, not now, but I'm not a prophet. I don't know what would happen in the future, which he's hiding. It's an insinuation. It's also an insinuation. He's just hiding behind the fact that he's essentially saying he would do it, just not now. Right. But he's using words to evade accountability and say, you know, I'm not saying now, who knows? Anybody who is sane would condemn the killing of people based on faultless people, based on their race or their culture. They would just deny it outright. They would condemn it outright, especially somebody who aspires to be the president of such a people. So it seems to me that these reasons are substantive. I've seen certain analysts, you know, make it seems as though the UK's reasons are flimsy. Yes, the UK, like any other country, has a prerogative to deny visas. But these are very substantive reasons, details, tweets, dated statements that he's made in public. And even I think that there's an inference to statements that he made under oath. So during a court case, it seems to me that they went through at great length to actually show him why he's an unfit citizen to be on UK grounds.
So, Morris, I guess one of the important questions to ask in this one then is, what exactly is going to be the political consequence of this domestically? The most recent poll we've seen from the Social Research Foundation, which came out quite recently, shows the EFF support cratering, with most of it seeming to be eaten up by the MK and the DA. With that poll having the EFF, I think, only at 3%. And, you know, Malema has used the White House thing to try and gin up energy for the party again. Do you think this will benefit him? What's your take on this and how it'll affect his fortunes?
I think he'll definitely try to use it to show his, you know, prove that the West is after him and this is all a imperial plot and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure it'll actually really work. As you said, the SRF data has shown that they're doing pretty poorly, and in by-elections across the country, EFF has done really badly. There's a couple of the handful where they've pushed the ANC hard, but in most places, the ANC, the EFF isn't doing well. And also, since I think I mentioned on the show before, in the last 18 months or so, the EFF hasn't stood in every single by-election when it used to do that, even in places where it had absolutely no hope. About 2 years ago, it won zero votes in a by-election in you know, a gated estate in Middelburg, for example. But so I think it's telling now that it's not standing in every by-election. I think there's probably organizational and perhaps financial issues with the EFF. But I think there's also a good example of the F around and find out. You know, Malema has been saying this kind of stuff for years now, and obviously the British government's got had enough of it. I also don't think that Donald Trump, what he's been saying, really had an effect, because we know at the moment in the UK it's a Labour government, and Keir Starmer. I mean, you know, Labour and the Republicans would be pretty far ideologically apart. And I don't think Keir Starmer would necessarily be a fan of Donald Trump. So, yeah, so I don't really think this has got too much to do with the British government. But we never know. I mean, these things can also be complex. But, yeah, I think he'll definitely try to use this and say, look, this is an imperial plot. These people are terrible. They don't want to let me go there, even though, you know, it's the heart of white supremacy. That's why I want to go there and just have a look because it's so terrible, whatever. You know, it's also typical of all these, you get these... often these woke academics will tell you know, the West is so terrible, we must decolonize and Africanize, and their dream is to get a job working in New York or London or, you know, one of the, like, we're a very European place. You don't see them looking for jobs at the University of Timbuktu or Addis Ababa or whatever the case is. So, but I think this is quite similar. And yeah, as I say, it's a case of effing around and finding out, and that's what's happened to Julius Malema now, I think.
McCorner, any final thoughts?
I can see him take up the populist posture of turning this around and, like, going to the Middle East, you know, hanging around Gaza when bombs are flying and, you know, showing the people that at least he's welcome here. You know, the imperialist white supremacist powers, Western powers may not want him, but he's welcome among the terrorist groups there in the Middle East. But I suspect he wouldn't do that. Malema likes his comforts. So, no, I agree with Morris that I don't see the influence of the Trump administration being that pervasive here. And I think we discussed pre the show, just to speak to what Morris spoke about in terms of the decline of the EFF's visibility and showing in by-elections, as he is a good mobilizer, but he needs to be paired with somebody like Floyd, who, you know, it seems he was the guy who was conscientious in putting together these infrastructures that, you know, in pairing it with rhetoric would actually do the work of getting people to by-elections, you know, campaigning during those by-elections, getting together basically the infrastructure that underlays parts of the party, parts of politicking that require, you know, showing up to polls. But yeah, he seemed it may be a consequence of the loss of somebody like Floyd and others who have left the EFF.
Although, while I'm sure Malema is not super psyched about it being denied his visa to the UK, he's probably very happy to see the troubles that Floyd is now in. A little bit like when your partner breaks up with you and then their next relationship goes down in flames very quickly, and you sort of have a vindictive, sadistic, smug feeling in you. I think that's probably how Malema's feeling a bit right now.
Also, okay. Maybe happy because now a pint in London is about £7, I think. So he's probably going to save a lot of money by not being able to go to the UK.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I don't think Malema has those kind of problems, Marius. The man wears Louis Vuitton, Gucci. Come on. £7 of pie? Come on.
A pint, not a pie. A pint, as in a draft beer. Yeah.
I still don't think he has those problems.
All right. Weird, the sort of UK coming up again in our discussions today. But so as any regular listener of this podcast knows, I do sometimes struggle a bit with pronunciation of surnames, this one is going to cause me problems. But I'm sure you will get who I'm trying to talk about. Magda Vitschke, I think, is her name, the head of the investment company Stigna, I think it's called, has written a piece for The Telegraph in the UK criticizing the Labour government's new inheritance tax. It's been some interesting opposition to that inheritance tax from a number of quite famous people. I think Jeremy Clarkson also attacking it from a perspective of farming recently. But that's neither here nor there. Signia, sorry, is the name of her company. She is South African born, and she says that she will return to South Africa soon if the inheritance tax rules are not changed. She said that the inheritance that tax changes in the UK were causing her problems. There were no buyers for her flat because there's so many wealthy people leaving the UK right now. And she's recently had to fire 12 of her household staff, including gardeners, cleaners, and builders, because of some of the financial concerns that are being developed, created for her because of these tax changes. She also went on to say that she really wants to basically have her inheritance given to her children, and that the UK's tax laws combined with South Africa's exchange controls would have serious, could cause serious complications for her being able to pass on wealth to her children when she passes away. Why are we talking about this? Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that this is a great example of why wealth taxes and inheritance taxes and things are often quite counterproductive. In the UK, what's happening is since these changes have been made, there have been a significant number of very wealthy people, dollar millionaires, dollar billionaires, leaving the country to go and live in places where their taxes are more protected. In the 21st century, when it's pretty easy to travel around the world, when there's all these financial and communication technologies that connect people, moving to another country if you're super rich is easier than ever before. And that means taking the tax you'd pay with you. It also, I think, shows that South Africa, if we get some things right, has a real opportunity to nab some of these people. We know that the South African tax base is overwhelmingly supported by a very small number of taxpayers who pay a huge percentage of the income tax. Getting more of them would help the fiscus enormously. And to do so, we need to make sure that we don't adopt the same kind of policies that would drive wealthy earners away from the country. You know, if we can't get them to invest their money in businesses, at least they can come here and pay us some tax on their income and capital gains and all that sort of thing. That would be nice, as long as it's not too harsh to drive them away. Makone, what do you make of this story? I mean, it's sort of a weird story because it comes off as kind of like, you know, I've had to fire 12 of my staff. Oh, woe is me, which is not something that will get you a lot of sympathy normally when you're very wealthy. But I think that that would be sort of missing the point of what's really going on here. What's your take on this?
It really is hard to sympathize with billionaires when they say things like that. I'm even reminded of Mahlengi Bengu's response to Mike Sham when he was asking about investors. And how PE is a deterrent to investments. And she said, let them go to India or Indonesia or wherever. And I'm afraid that is most people's attitudes to billionaires. And as you point out, Nick, at least Signia is headquartered in South Africa. I'm not sure, I may be mistaken. I think it's headquartered in Cape Town. But even if it's not, having somebody like her and other, South Africa has lots of these sort of people who became rich, left the country, or left the country, then became rich, who we should welcome with open arms because they make up the majority of our tax contributions in South Africa. So it's always beneficial to have laws. You know, BE is usually the target of our criticism because it affects so many people. But even inheritance and wealth taxes are exemplary in terms of having policy that's just anti-investment, anti-attracting people of that caliber who would spend their money here in South Africa. And we'd all benefit enormously from their presence here. So I'm afraid she doesn't help herself when she starts describing her lifestyle, but there is a very strong case to be made about easing laws and regulations in South Africa so that they are welcoming, whether it's business, whether it's high net worth individuals, so that they are welcome here and can spend their money here.
And of course, it's not like that money goes nowhere. As I was saying, it goes to tax, but also, you know, when you have high flyers running around, going to your restaurants and buying things and splashing money about, it also helps lower income people very directly in that they will get sort of jobs or extra economic activity where they live. Maurice, your take on this story?
Yeah, it's just a very first world problems piece, I think. You know, like, oh no, I have to fire 12 of my staff and I can't sell my massive house in London. Oh, jeez, so terrible. And I think Magda Virchika, she's a very good example of somebody who's obviously very good at some things I mean, she's built a very good business. She's obviously very smart in some things, but I think she's one of those people you mustn't rely on for political analysis. I was actually talking to somebody about it today, and I remember when it was Human Rights Day, so the anniversary of the Sharpeville massacre, and she had a photo, or that famous photo. I can't remember the guy who was carrying it, but of Hector Peterson having just been shot, and saying, to in commemoration of that day. And it's like, lady, it's a completely different incident, And she was big on the Ramaphosa hype train, back in the day. And when, most people could see through all the smoke and mirrors of around Ramaphosa and so on, but she couldn't, because obviously, he
I think
speaks so
she's switched
well and all that
now
kind of thing. Yes, but
to being quite critical. So, but yeah, no, she was very much on the New Dawn train
yes,
to begin with.
exactly. So yeah, but I think you also make a good point that South Africa's got there is real potential to get people to come to South Africa. Like it's such a bit of a silly thing, but I mean, the weather's great here. There's lots of things to do. There's we talk about like there's cheap beer and cheap wine or whatever, and you've got the game farms and all that kind of stuff. It's a place that you could really attract people to. And as an aside, I've got a friend. She works for a PR firm in London, and one of her bosses, he's literally a lord. He's got an inherited title and so on. And he was actually at Prince Harry's wedding. He was one of his best men, can believe it or not. Anyway, he got married recently. Where did he have the reception? At a wine farm in Cape Town. That's where and he spends like 3 months of the year in Cape Town, whatever the case is. And people might talk about, these digital nomads are pushing the prices up in Cape Town. That might be the case, but you're probably getting more economic activity if you make it easy for these people to come here. Nobody's saying that, somebody must just come and not contribute or whatever the case is. But if somebody's coming as a digital nomad, they're probably bringing a lot of money into the country, and there's lots of economic multipliers that come from, somebody coming here and spending money that they wouldn't have been spent otherwise. And obviously, these things must be managed. We've seen that property prices in Cape Town have gone up a lot, and it's been a problem in other parts of the world, not just digital nomads, but over tourism and so on. These are things that have to be managed, but they are also ways to boost the economies. So there's, you've got to harness the power that will come from this kind of thing. So, but yeah, overall, I think it was quite a funny story, and I think it tells a lot about Magda that she's willing to tell people that she's, life's so terrible because she had to fire her butler and her footman and her lady in waiting and whatever the case is.
My sense is she would like to return home, but as she says, she perceives there's a threat to her life because she was instrumental in the Gupta leaks, right? So I think she fears she may be a target to those factions in our political system.
I see that, but I mean, oh, sorry, Kara.
Yeah, but I was just saying,
What are you
I
saying?
think she does
Sorry.
want to come back home, but if the threat looming over her life is legitimate, then it does justifiably explain why she escaped.
But I was just going to say, like, when we have seen like these kind of assassinations and so on, but it's terrible. It's only like kind of like low level people. The people who do get like Babita Deokaran, I think her name was, that whistleblower at Tembisa Hospital. She wasn't a famous person. It's not like MECs and so on that are getting killed. Like, I think somebody like Magda, she probably needs to have some kind of security, but I don't think, you're not going to get a Gupta SWAT team coming to a mansion in Pretoria and trying to kill her, whatever the case is.
No, she could replace the 15 butler staff with 15 security guards tomorrow. Well, I think her role specifically may have been akin to that Babita Deokaran played in the Tembisa Hospital scandal, right? So I'm not sure that it's a matter of rank, like how highly you are in society, but how big the role you played in exposing the corruption was, and that Babita had her finger on it. And so I don't know her Magda's specific role, but perhaps it's just as sizable.
But I think this does raise a sort of larger question, which is that, one of the issues with attracting wealthy people to South Africa is, of course, crime. And as long as you have kind of organized crime and mafias running around, it doesn't really matter whether they're trying to, arrest you, assassinate you, or kidnap you, or whatever, or rob you because of your political views or just because of your cash. It's still exactly the kind of thing that's going to chase away very wealthy people who we could be getting here to fund all the development programs and all the infrastructure we need. It's very frustrating how, you know, South Africa, we do have these great opportunities before us. We have this really beautiful environment. We could be getting people, these rich people, and have a sensible tax regime which gives them good reasons to come here, but still get some money from them. We could use that to pay for all the infrastructure stuff we need. But we miss the opportunities because of either ideological obsession with smashing the capitalist wealthy class, whatever, or alternatively, just because of crime and general mismanagement. Makone, final thoughts?
I was going to add that she's also been very vocal about that, about trying to, you know, get startups in South Africa investment and make the investment case in places like America and in Europe. And she said it's very difficult. South Africa is just simply unattractive. And even though we have some of the most creative, most innovative, technologically advanced startups, it's just very difficult to get them support because of the laws and outputs. And I think she was speaking about things like BEE. So yeah, she's a good ambassador to have in our corner.
All right, let's just do one last story before we close up for today, because this is one of those stories that's so sort of bonkers, it kind of makes my head spin around. But anyone who looks at South African polling on what institutions South Africans trust and don't trust, the police routinely come out as one of the least trusted institutions in the country. And it's stories like this one from the Daily Maverick, which kind of really highlight why that is. According to this report, a Nelson Mandela Bay police officer who pleaded guilty in an internal disciplinary process to charges of armed robbery, possession of stolen property, and possession of an unlicensed firearm has returned to work in the police force in the Child Protection Unit after a 2-month suspension. He is still, as far as I understand, facing the criminal charges related to that armed robbery in the criminal system. So, you know, presumably he's going to go on trial at some point. But this is one of 12 police officers who just in the Eastern Cape, this was revealed by, I think, a legislature question by DA MPL, said that there are 12 officers with criminal convictions currently serving in SAPS in the Eastern Cape. And there are 217 cases involving police officers under investigation. Most of the people who have these convictions were guilty for helping prisoners escape, I believe is the reason given. There were a couple for fraud, and there was one which was reckless and negligent driving, which is, you know, I would say somewhat less extreme than some of the others. But Makone, I don't know what to say. This is just so mad.
I'm just as floored that we are being policed by criminals, you know, and this is a problem that's widespread in the civil service. We have a lot of people who are offenders, even in the education department. I think, Marius, you and I spoke about this when it was revealed that some 600 members of the Free State Education Department have criminal convictions, and perhaps some of them are reformed, but where they are specifically related to, like, the assault of children, you know, sexual offenders, specifically of minors, it's a no-brainer. How do we not have the correct vetting mechanisms? But even when you do, this case demonstrates, even when you can vet them, right? Even when somebody confesses to perpetrating a crime, doesn't matter, they're just back on the force after a 2-month suspension. So it shouldn't surprise us, you know, that we have this caliber of people in our civil service, and that, you know, the police are just unwilling to do anything about this. In fact, they help them, right? Because one of the things they speak about is that during this hearing that this police officer had, it was a captain instead of somebody higher ranking, like a brigadier, who was conducting this disciplinary hearing. So they're clearly protecting each other. Something needs to change about that. I'm not quite sure what yet, but I am also equally floored.
I think there's many, many things one can do to fix the police service. It starts with, you know, just, for example, having the political will to follow through on the processes of firing people who aren't competent or compromised. But I do also think there might be room for special investigative units to assist like IPED or to strengthen IPED to actually look into this stuff and be like, okay, well, there are real consequences for police officers, for soldiers, for people in positions of authority like this who break the law or who, you know, have gross misconduct. In fact, you know, the fact that he pleaded guilty in an internal disciplinary hearing, like that should have been enough cause to be fired. Never mind the criminal stuff that goes on. The law has to take its course. He needs to go to court for all that. But if you're running anything approaching a proper disciplinary process, that is enough to be fired. And the fact that there was a 2-month suspension is just madness. Morris, what do you make of this?
I don't know. I think you guys are being unfair. Like I said before the show, he's in the child protection unit. He's not in the armed robbery unit. So as long as he wasn't caught for like noncing or having, you know, dodgy pics of kids on his computer, I think that's perfectly fine. So I think you people need to rethink the way you guys think about the police.
You heard it here first, guys. The armed robbery, not so bad, says Marius. but yeah, no, the infiltration of criminal elements into the police is, I think, one of the most serious problems in the country that no one has even really begun to tackle. And until that is tackled, you can actually make a whole bunch of other policy changes that would be positive. You're going to really run up to, against some roadblocks.
I just want to say one thing quick. I mean, there are obviously serious problems with the police, but I've in the last couple of months, I've had some incidents. I've had to deal with the police about 3 times. And every time, they've been very professional and very friendly. And I think, yeah, I think there's still lots of good people in the police. There's obviously, I mean, these, we can't ignore these problems, and these problems of infiltration by criminal elements has been a long-running problem for, you know, 20, 30 years. But I think there's a lot of people who want to try to do the right thing and want this country to work, and a lot of them are in the police, I think. And we also need to give credit to where it's due. And I was obviously joking. I think if you have been caught with, if you have admitted to armed robbery, you probably shouldn't be in the cops, even if you are just in the child protection unit.
I think this actually is one of the important points about that, Morris, is not just that, you know, we should give credit where it's due and that there are good people in the cops. It shows that if you start to turn the tide on these things, you'll actually see the system come right faster than you think, because those people who do their jobs properly will have the room to breathe, will get that morale boost, and they can start actually improving the system.
There's, I don't know if this is an apocryphal story or if it really happened, but there's a tale of the of these monkeys in Japan. You've probably seen in front of them, those gray monkeys that sometimes chill in those like steam baths, those natural springs or whatever. And there's a story like the one monkey, he realized what you start, if he gets, if he finds fruit on the ground and he washes it, then it's a bit more tasty. And then other monkeys would see him doing it and so on. Then suddenly all monkeys in Japan started doing it. And obviously they couldn't all see each other. And there's a theory called the 100th monkey thing. That once, you know, there's a critical mass of people doing a certain thing, then it infects everybody. Like, apparently the story is not true, but it's a nice little story. And, yeah, it's sometimes I think about it. But, like, if the 100th monkey thing could happen, I mean, it's, yeah, it's, then if you just get enough people doing the right thing, then this, you get this critical mass, it'll take you to the right place.
I do think there is something about sort of the cultural norms in a workplace. You know, every workplace has, as the kids would say, a vibe. And if that vibe is, oh, nothing matters, it's hopeless, we're all just being treated badly, you might as well steal as you can, because, you know, eventually you're going to get fired or shot in the line of duty, which I suspect is how it feels in a lot of places in the police right now. If that vibe changes to, guys, we're actually here to protect and serve, we're actually turning the tide, we are the heroes saving society from the rot, the multiplier effect of that is very serious. McCornia, final thoughts for today from you.
That does start with holding people to a very high standard, right? And keeping people with criminal convictions on the police force when police would actually make the best criminals, right? Because they know how to break the rules and how to get away with it. When those opportunities arise, it's even more needed and necessary that the rules and the standards police are held to are elevated. And we saw this with when Minister Pieter Groenewald came along and he said, you know, even the gardens outside correctional facilities must show that, you know, the correctional officers take pride in their work, even how they dress, how they put on their uniform, because they play this important role in society of keeping us all safe. So it starts in those little things, taking care of the pennies and the pounds, taking care of themselves, something like that.
Oh, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I just think if you go to like the union buildings and you walk around there, you know, there'll be those gardens and there's rubbish in the gardens and whatever. If you walk past Downing Street in the UK or go to Buckingham Palace, the place is pristine. There's no rubbish. It's, you know, like we can talk about the differences, but I mean, that's one place where the presidency should say to Twine Air Council, you must clean this every day. There's no, we don't want one thing of rubbish here, because it says something about the country and about where you work and so on, I think.
Well said. All right. I think that's more than enough for today. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will, of course, be back on Monday with the Daily Friend Wrap. We'll see you all then. I hope you all have a magnificent and wonderful weekend. Cheers.